Hear that? It's the sound of you catching up on all the latest and greatest fintech news, trends, and updates thanks to Streetworthy, Yield Street's bi-weekly newsletter. Stay in the know with CEO Milind Mahiri as he takes a closer look at what's happening in the fintech space, then breaks down what each story could mean for investors like you. Give your portfolio the edge it deserves and subscribe to Streetworthy on LinkedIn today.
Welcome to The Yield, the official podcast of Yield Street. Every week, we bring you the latest market insights across our asset classes and products from subject matter experts. Our aim is to break the outdated mold of investing and help you add financial fuel to your ambitions through innovative investing products and strategies typically unavailable to most investors. Realize your next level with The Yield. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. The views you are about to hear do not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street. This podcast is intended to be strictly informational and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a research report, investment advice, or the offer or sale of securities or any investment product. Now, let's get into the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another live episode of The Yield. Be sure to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube, and leave a review if you enjoy the content. In case we haven't met before, I'm Peter Kerr. I'm the Director of Product Marketing here at Yield Street. And today I'm joined by Ajit Tripathi. Ajit leads institutional growth strategy and partnerships at Aave that enables institutions to participate in decentralized finance. Previously, he built banking and payment rails for Binance and Paxful and led the build out of a UK blockchain business for PwC. Ajit is a crypto co-host of Breaking Banks FinTech podcast and a columnist for CoinDesk, in addition to being an active angel investor in high-quality crypto startups. Ajit, welcome to the show. Why don't you start off with just telling our audience a little bit more about yourself?
Yeah, thank you, Peter. So I've been in the crypto space for almost 5.5 years now. And before that, I was in capital markets, technology and change. I worked across the middle back office for four different investment banks. So I have a pretty in-depth background in products, financial products and technology systems integration and so on. I'm an engineer by trade, so so DeFi is kind of a natural home. And one of the things that I also did between PwC and Binance is put out the fintech practice for Consensus, which is the largest Ethereum-focused business in the world. So I think now we see a lot of new interesting things going on in the whole Web3 space, and we're going to talk about it in the show. But I'm looking forward to speaking about it in your show, and it's just something I really enjoy doing. It's great to be on the show.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. So it's interesting. You mentioned you started about 5 years or so ago, which I think most people peg crypto sort of starting in the 2007-2008 period.
2008 is when Bitcoin was white paper came out. Yeah.
What got you started? How come you decided to jump in?
I could tell you a more interesting story, but I was just bored doing what I was doing at PwC, and it was consulting can be fun, but I think some of the audit parts are not fun at all. And at that time, fintech was really exciting. There was a lot going on in fintech, and one of the in this whole blockchain space was seen as an area of fintech, and there was a lot of buzz starting to happen with Blightmasters and a few other people sort of going around and saying, hey, this thing is going to disrupt Wall Street, it's going to change how we build financial infrastructure. And nobody else really wanted to do it because there was no real revenue in it. So I saw sort of a greenfield opportunity, and I thought, okay, if no one wants to do it, and this thing looks really interesting, I'm just going to go do it, right? And then I also did this early in-depth course on Coursera by Arvind Narayanan, who is a professor at FinTech, and so I'm a tech guy. So I'm not going to say things like, I wanted to disrupt banks, or I wanted to, revolutionize Wall Street. None of that. I really thought the technology was incredibly interesting. There were lots of great things that could be built with it. And as an engineer, that's really provoked my fancy. So I found a really great opportunity at PwC that no one really wanted to get into. So I got into it, I took hold of it and ran with it.
So it's funny. I mean, when you think back to kind of that time period that you really got involved, I would say that acceptance was growing. But I think relative to now, you know, crypto is probably much more widely accepted now than it was. What kind of gave you the confidence then, you know, with a lot of naysayers out there to kind of really forge forward?
Yeah, I don't think that's hard. You know, I'm from the 1997-98 Web2 generation. I mean, if you see an interesting problem and it seems like fun and it seems worth doing, you just go do it. Back in 2015, in fact, everybody thought Bitcoin was for money launderers, and you couldn't actually go to a bank and have a sensible conversation about using Bitcoin in a banking environment. So everybody wanted to talk about blockchain technology, and that too in the context of the private blockchain space. Like DLT was the big thing. So for me, it wasn't so much a matter of confidence. I just thought the technology was really fascinating. And, you know, it was complex. It was, you could build systems with blockchain that you couldn't build, you know, trustless systems that you couldn't build without the technology. So it had a very specific, it was just so interesting that I wanted to do it. So it wasn't kind of a strategic decision. No, there's a big future in it, or, you know, we are all going to get rich or anything. It's just too interesting to not do.
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, for our listeners who maybe are a little bit less experienced, you know, there's obviously crypto, which is, a little bit all encompassing, but there's also technology like blockchain that underpins a lot of the cryptocurrencies out there. Then there's this other concept that we're going to spend a lot of time on today, which is DeFi or decentralized finance. Maybe you could kind of start, in a building block sense of kind of explaining crypto, and then also maybe contrasting that versus what the blockchain is.
Yeah. So you know, blockchain technology is essentially a distributed systems technology, right? So for example, when I run a program on my computer and it's the only computer that's running that program, then that's not distributed, right? It's just one computer that's running that program. Now, if I run that program, you know, break it into parts and run that software on multiple computers, then that's kind of what you call distributed computing, right? You take a piece of computation problem and then you run it on multiple computers. So there are multiple distributed computing paradigms. One is cloud computing, like Amazon Web Services that everyone is familiar with. And then there is also, you know, this idea of blockchain, where you rely on consensus, where you rely on multiple computers agreeing on what gets written to a shared database. So what's really cool about this is that, you know, you can create systems like Bitcoin or Ethereum, where, you know, no one entity, no company or individual controls the system. But then we sort of, you know, in a trustless environment where nobody trusts each other, or doesn't have to trust any particular single entity like a bank or a central bank, you can create this concept of, data that cannot be copied. And the genius of Bitcoin is that for the first time, it created a way for a set of computers to agree on a piece of data and then made it impossible for people to copy that data, right? Without being detected. So on the internet, when you send out an email, then anyone can copy that email. But when you actually, no one can copy a Bitcoin, right? Because if you copy a Bitcoin, it's worthless because the Bitcoin network as a whole doesn't agree on what happened on the transaction. So if I'm getting a little bit complex here, so Bitcoin was the first time that on the internet you could create something that was unique, that was not, you know, copyable, that, you know, nobody could copy, and therefore it had some kind of value, right? So if you copy a dollar bill, then that copy of a dollar bill has no value. Whereas if that dollar bill, the only way that dollar bill has value, if you cannot double spend it, i.e. you cannot copy it. So Bitcoin sort of was a fundamental technological change. And the technology it uses underneath it, the set of technologies in combination that Bitcoin uses to make that happen, it's called blockchain technology, right? So it's a distributed systems technology that makes it impossible for people to, for a piece of data to be uniquely identified and not copied. So now, then in the enterprise space, what people said is, look, we don't need these coins. There is no value in this. You know, we don't need the coin idea. We don't need the monetary token. We're just going to deploy this technology in a corporate environment. Now, that idea was there for a while, but now that idea hasn't really worked. And you know, now what we're seeing is this idea of applications that are deployed on the public internet on blockchain technology without outside of any firewalls, right? So not inside any particular company, not controlled by any particular individual. So more and more applications are coming through that are now being deployed on public blockchains, blockchains that no one controls, blockchains that are not hidden inside a firewall, blockchains that anyone can access, right? So that type of permissionless, where you don't need anybody's permission to connect to blockchains technology, that's kind of the dominant technology paradigm right now. So, and the second part of your question, decentralized finance. So Bitcoin created the concept of, you know, decentralized money, right? Money, a money token or a piece of value that was not issued by a central bank, that was not controlled by a bank, or, you know, where you didn't need anybody's permission. You could just start a computer, run Bitcoin software, and suddenly you were on the network and you could transact if you're using a basic wallet. So that was a bit of a revolution. Then Ethereum came along, and Ethereum created this idea that instead of just creating a simple money token called Bitcoin, you could create really complex programs that, you know, did very interesting things, where you could give this piece of money more complex behavior, right? So for example, when you look at forms of value like stocks have very complex behavior. They have dividends, they have, you know, stocks have cash flows, bonds have different types of cash flows. So with Ethereum, you could create a whole bunch of, you know, tokens or different types of applications that made it possible for people to use really sophisticated forms of value. Now, on top of that, using Ethereum technology, a whole new class of applications has been deployed, which we call decentralized finance. And in decentralized finance, you just, you know, you don't simply have a token or a simple idea of notion. You build something more complex again. You build applications where you can, you know, earn a yield, where you can essentially do trading, where you can do borrowing and lending activity, where you can do really, you know, more interesting financial applications. You can build really interesting financial applications in a completely permissionless, decentralized environment, meaning in an environment that, you know, no particular individual entity controls and is on the open internet. So this way of building systems which are, you know, really not controlled by any particular entity but can be used by anyone is a truly revolutionary idea. And that's why decentralized finance is so big right now.
Going back, one thing you mentioned, you talked both about Bitcoin and then also about Ethereum. And I'm just curious, you know, most people just think about those as being different coins, but their underpinning or the underlying technology is actually substantially different as well. You know, can you maybe just elaborate on the different type of coins that they're out there and then some of the technologies? And also, you know, to that point, you know, I think a lot of people are viewing Ethereum as the blockchain of the future, whereas Bitcoin right now might be a little bit more of a data technology relative, but maybe you can expand on that too.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think, you know, so Bitcoin, it was, you know, so even before Bitcoin, there were multiple experiments to try to create internet money, right? So even Mark Andreessen wanted to have a money token on the next day browser. Adam Back built something called Hashcash that used the Bitcoin proof of work algorithm. So the proof of work algorithm came from Hashcash to Bitcoin. So there is a whole history of people and cryptographers trying to create internet money on the internet that does not rely on central banks or any particular company or so on, right? Now, so Ethereum is a further advancement on Bitcoin. So Bitcoin's proof of work algorithm, the actual underlying mining algorithm was modified by Ethereum. And Ethereum added this, you know, completely clean, separate layer of programming layer. So on Ethereum, on Bitcoin, you can write programs that are very, very simple. On Ethereum, you can write programs that are very, very complex, right? So Ethereum added something new to Bitcoin. So it's the next step. Now, even today, we are seeing new blockchains come around that add further new ideas to Ethereum, right? So if you look at Polkadot, Solana, there are a few other blockchains that are really building more and more interesting things on top of the, by using some of the ideas that have been in Bitcoin and Ethereum. So the technology continues to grow. Obviously, when people own coins, they get a little bit attached to the coins they own. And, you know, so Ethereum holders say, oh, Ethereum is the best. And Bitcoin holders say, Bitcoin is the best. But when you think about this as a technologist, then each one of these blockchains represents an advancement or progress in the state of blockchain technology. So Ethereum is also evolving. You know, Ethereum is moving from to a different consensus algorithm. Ethereum is scaling. Ethereum is becoming more complex and more sophisticated. So, from a technology standpoint, you know, Ethereum adds new features and new capabilities on top of what Bitcoin was able to do. And then other blockchains are doing the same thing on Ethereum. Right now, from a coin perspective, I think people get very attached to the coins they want. And that's just the life of crypto.
Well, how do you see all of it playing out, you know, forecasting out 10 years from now? You know, are there, you know, a few dominant winners in the coin space, or do you, and also obviously in the technology space, we talk about other applications as well. Or do you feel as though, you know, each year, each new cycle, there'll be advancements in the technology and the future, you know, prominent coin is yet to even be developed?
Yeah, so what we have learned about blockchain technology is, right, that it's impossible to design a blockchain that that maximizes security, decentralization, and, you know, and user experience, so a transaction throughput, for example. So you have to trade one of these parameters against the other, which means, you know, this is Vitalik's famous trilemma. Which means that depending on the applications you are trying to build, you have to trade one thing for the other, right? So you can have a blockchain that's less decentralized, but really fast, like Solana, for example, right now. Or you can have a blockchain that's much more decentralized, like Bitcoin is quite decentralized. Ethereum is now very decentralized, but it does not have as much throughput. So it depends on what you're trying to achieve. And so just like databases are a design space, you know, blockchains are also a wide design space where you kind of say, okay, what do I want my blockchain to do? What do I want my blockchain to be used for? Now, Ethereum is the most general purpose blockchain that's out there. And, you know, with technologies that have been built like Polygon or, you know, now layer two solutions that are coming on Ethereum to scale it, there are lots of different things you can do on Ethereum. And, you know, Ethereum is always growing as a family of technologies. But at the same time, there has been a lot of innovation in the blockchain space. You have Cosmos, where you can deploy application-specific, you know, blockchains, where you sort of, they say, this, you know, a blockchain is optimized for this particular application set. You have Polkadot, where you sort of, you know, have a common framework for deploying, you know, arbitrary complex blockchains. There are also, you know, blockchains that are coming along that are optimized for different things that maximize transaction throughput, reduce the gas fee. So I think depending on what you're trying to do, you can always choose a different blockchain. What we have seen is, you know, the winner so far, if we could point at a winner, yeah, Ethereum is a winner, but it's not the only winner. Ethereum virtual machines, you know, the programming language for Ethereum Solidity, and the environment in which you run these programs have kind of been dominant, and almost everyone is ending up adopting that. But that's still very early. So I think, you know, when you think about this in the internet history terms, then I think we are still in, you know, we have got to email. I think current DeFi is more like Hotmail. It's widely used. There are lots of people. It's the first email app, you know, so on and so forth. But it's still, there are, you know, apart from DeFi and NFTs and some crypto games, there isn't a lot out there that you can point at and say, oh yeah, this Web3, the new internet has arrived in the shape of blockchains. So I think, how do I see the future? I think, you know, we'll see lots of innovation in the underlying tech stack. We will see blockchains that are optimized for different uses. We'll see protocols or technologies that connect all of these blockchains and, you know, allow users to sort of interact with all of these in a consistent way. So Aave, for example, you know, the our team is building a truly cross-chain protocol. So Aave has been deployed on Ethereum, Polygon. We're deploying on Avalanche, which is another, you know, a new blockchain, and we're going to deploy on you know, some layer twos, Solana at some point, and Polkadot. So I think there will be a small number of winners that are optimized for different users, but then people will be able to build blockchains that are specifically, you know, really suited for what they're trying to do with it.
Very interesting. And I say this half jokingly, but there was one coin, and I know we focus more on coin than I initially intended, but you haven't brought up ticker DOGE. Have you heard of it?
Yeah. In fact, Elon Musk, Doge, absolutely. And Vitalik is now on the foundation too. So Doge is actually surprisingly promising. I watched those very, very closely. I mean, I can't comment on the coin. I think the coins are not for me to discuss. But the technology has its uses. You know, it's essentially merged mine with Litecoin, and you can do a lot of cheap transactions on Dogecoin. So Elon might be right about it in terms of using it for payments. Right.
So, you know, one of the things that our audience comes to us a lot about is just, you know, around portfolio allocation. And it's my last question on coins, I promise. But without specifying any coins, but thinking about crypto in terms of an investment, how do you view about even including it, if at all, in a portfolio? And then let's spend some time talking about Aave.
Yeah, so I think it would be... you know, let's say you go back to 1989 or 1990, and you find out that there's something called the internet being built, right? Now you get 99, and at that time you decide not to buy into it, and you know there's you get a chance to invest in and hold a small portion of that multi-trillion-dollar internet economy, and you say no to that. Okay, good for you. You know, whatever. Maybe it's not your risk appetite. Now you come to 96, 97. And the dot-com boom is just starting, and you say, oh, this is not for me, and it's too scary, I don't understand it. I think that's pretty stupid, right? I mean, to be very blunt. To not have any exposure to crypto at this time, when you kind of clearly see applications coming along, so many developers and technologists building some clear users coming along, I think that's a mistake. So almost every portfolio should have some crypto allocation. Because not having exposure to this, you know, the new internet that's being built. Think about it this way: if you have 1% allocation to crypto in an endowment portfolio, it could 100x over the next, you know, 5-10 years minimum. If you ask me, or you will lose 1%, right? I mean, it's a no brainer. If there is a no brainer in the investment world, then I think it's in the crypto. It is having some exposure to crypto.
Oh, very interesting. So maybe, you know, you briefly started touching on Aave, but maybe you can kind of just walk through, you know, what you all try to achieve, and then we can kind of go into a little bit more about DeFi.
Yeah, so Aave was, you know, started by Stani Kulichov, my boss, and the team back in 2017. It's one of the earliest DeFi protocols around. So when, you know, most of us didn't really know about DeFi, but I was quite interested in DeFi, Aave. Then called ETHLang was building out a protocol for one of the first protocols in decentralized finance. 4 years later, now we are a family of, you know, protocols, a very large community of over 80,000 plus Aave token holders, and, you know, probably tens of times that contributors, Discord, Telegram, Twitter, followers and members, and, you know, so Aave is what we call a DeFi blue chip, in the sense that it's one of the most well-known DeFi protocols. What Aave does is it enables, you know, people to, it creates a market for liquidity, right? So if you have excess cash, for example, you can deposit cash in the form of stable coins, right? So you have to have some crypto form of assets, and you can deposit stable coins or other crypto assets to earn a yield on those assets, right? So, and the yield is paid by borrowers who borrow these assets. So I deposit, you deposit and I borrow that. So I pay you a yield. So this type of, but you don't know me, right? So it's done in a mutualized way, in the sense that you deposit your assets in a pool, other people borrow those assets from a pool, against the collateral they post. So it's all over collateralized borrowing. And, you know, it's essentially for borrowing, they pay a yield that's then, you know, passed through to the suppliers of liquidity. So it essentially creates a much more efficient market for liquidity. And that's the core of the protocol. On top of that, I think there are lots of innovations that the community has built. So there's a social media protocol, there's a gaming related protocol, there are lots of people building lots of interesting things on the Aave protocol, because it's kind of this, you know, core base layer of DeFi in the sense of the market for liquidity.
So you talked earlier, you know, we kind of think about it like in terms of crypto lending, right? As far as your liquidity protocol, could you maybe just kind of walk us through what that sort of looked like? And you mentioned stable coins as well, which, you know, I know are an emerging concept for a lot of our listeners. So maybe you kind of expand on that as well, since I think they're becoming more and more popular and people are starting to use them, but still not as widely well known relative to traditional crypto.
Yeah. So stable coins are crypto assets that are backed by dollars or treasury bonds or other high quality liquid assets. And the most popular stable coins right now are Tether, which is simple USDT, USDC, which is Circle's stable coin, and then there are others like Paxos USDP. So these stable coins have the idea that they use the underlying crypto technology, like Ethereum ERC20 tokens typically. And but their main property is that they hold their value, or they look to hold their value against the US dollar. So one USDC, for example, typically has give or take the value of $1, right? And whereas crypto assets like Bitcoin and Ethereum have a pretty volatile value, and it goes up and down a lot. So what Aave does is it allows you to, for example, deposit your Bitcoin, right? So you can deposit your Bitcoin in Aave, or your Ethereum in Aave, and then you can borrow against that collateral. So all these interactions are, when I say deposit, then you're not depositing it into a company. You're not giving your Bitcoin to me or to the any Aave team or anything. You're depositing the money in a smart contract that's controlled by token holder voting, right? So the first key idea is you can deposit your assets and earn a yield on those, or you can borrow against the collateral you have deposited and essentially pay a yield to other people who are essentially borrowing these, who are sort of supplying these assets. So, and the third thing there is it's decentralized in the sense that, it's not, so the protocol is not controlled by a company or an individual or a set of individuals. It's essentially all the decisions on the protocol are made by a DAO or a smart contract that is controlled by, token holder voting. And if you have any questions, please ask. I'm happy to, explain further.
Yeah, I'm just curious. I mean, so a lot of people are finding ways to essentially get liquidity from their crypto holdings and also, at a cost. And so some people are also lending in many terms to crypto borrowers. How does that kind of look like, and what type of yields are people generally getting?
So this is not the traditional lending type of transaction. It's basically a new type of, interaction. And the novelty is that, here you're not sort of, so you're not depositing money in my account. You're not giving your money to, let's say, a company like BlockFi or one of the other crypto lenders, Celsius or so on. What you're doing is you're depositing your assets in a smart contract, right? And that smart contract is a piece of software that is not running on the Ethereum protocol. So your counterparty, in the sense, is a smart contract, right? And that's a fundamentally new idea. Now, that smart contract actually represents a pool. So the assets are pooled, and then other people, if you're depositing into this pool, then other people can borrow from the pool. So, and those, the borrowers will then, be charged an interest rate for, with every Ethereum block per second. And, that interest is then allocated proportionately to the people who deposited the assets. So that's a fundamentally new type of interaction. If you really want to think of it in terms of lending, then it's not really lending in any sense of the word. But I think if you really wanted to sort of draw a parallel, then your counterparty in that case is a piece of code. It's a piece of software.
Very interesting. So as you kind of think forward to the next 5 years or so, what are some of the technologies that you think are coming that haven't yet really been introduced yet that get you really excited?
Yeah. So privacy is a big factor. So I think we're seeing a lot of innovation in zero knowledge proofs. We're seeing a lot of innovation on privacy preserving blockchain protocols. And the reason that's interesting is because now we are starting to see DeFi go from just individuals and crypto natives to really institutional users, right? So DeFi is starting to become the new Web3 open internet based market infrastructure. Right. So what will happen is that, fintechs, hedge funds, family offices, all of these various types of intermediaries and entities will plug into DeFi, into protocols like Aave and other DeFi protocols. to essentially, you know, in a sort of a secure, trustless environment, exchange value on a network, right? So that's sort of this idea of open permissionless Web3 market infrastructure to be used by institutions and individuals and governed by, you know, by an open community in a very transparent open source environment is actually fundamentally new, right? So, and what that does is, you know, one thing we have seen is it's starting to really drive home the future of work, right? So if you look at Aave protocol, we are a very small team. I think now we are, by DeFi standards, we are actually big now. We are almost 50 odd people, and but still very small, right? And the liquidity on Aave right now is around $24 billion. So it's a pretty scalable protocol. What's happening in Aave is that, you know, now lots and lots of code and software and innovation is coming not necessarily from the team members of the original team, but they are coming from just about anyone who has a good idea. You know, you don't need a degree to contribute to Aave. You don't need to go to Harvard to contribute to Aave. You can just be anyone with a good idea and anywhere. And, you know, that sort of permissionless innovation where anyone with a good idea can actually grow the protocol is kind of something I'm really excited about. And we are seeing things around NFTs, you know, decentralized social media. We're seeing, you know, DeFi as just the starting point. And the whole of Web3 commerce, social media, NFTs, and that, you know, those spaces really, really start to take over. Now, that's the one thing that's going to happen. So we are starting, you know, I think what you're seeing is the emergence of a whole new internet, right? And that internet is interesting in the sense that it addresses some of the gaps in what the current internet doesn't have. For example, it does not have a money token. If I want to send money on the internet today, the best I can do is, you know, use PayPal and send a transaction, which is bootstrapped. So where an email sort of represents I'm sending money, but then the money underlying flows through the traditional banking rails. The other thing we're starting to see is, you know, this idea, emergence of decentralized identity, where people are starting to issue DeFi passports, credit histories, on-chain behavior, rewards for good on-chain behavior in the real world. So this type of internet where you have this idea of digital money and digital identity baked in and digital reputation baked in, but while preserving privacy, I think it is fundamentally fixing some of the issues that I think Mark Andreessen wanted to fix back in 1995. So I'm really excited about that. And I was still around in 95 and I'm starting to see that happen finally.
So it does sound though like a lot of some of these DeFi concepts are kind of at odds with established governments or kind of, you know, some of these larger regulatory type entities. How do you kind of see this kind of like friction evolving over time?
Yeah, this is not the first time that has happened. You know, I mean, when e-commerce was starting, people were sending credit cards, numbers on the internet and to buy clothes a person in New Jersey would send their credit card number on the internet to buy a dress from California and the card number would get stolen, right? And so the technology happens first. At that time, there were similar concerns about Web2 or the internet. You know, people used to really worry about, oh, what happens if this falls in the hands of the Russians and, you know, so on and so forth. So I still remember quite a few of those conversations. So there is always fear around anything that's new. So some of the DeFi concepts, the new way of building systems and infrastructure, obviously create some anxieties. And especially when the technology is still maturing, you know, people tend to obviously have all sorts of concerns and some people tend to focus quite heavily on the risk aspect. But then I think, you know, we also have to think about the opportunity that's coming and that there are going to be, you know, policymakers and governments that start to see the opportunity. And we'll really get ahead. And that's kind of how Bill Clinton and Al Gore created the Do No Harm law, or rather created this Do No Harm, you know, philosophy. And I think we're going to start to see some of that again. And you know, the technology will mature. We're seeing an extraordinary amount of investment from both Web2 and Web3 players. So technology practices, you know, talent is coming in. So technology happens first. Market, it creates markets. And then, you know, lawmakers, policymakers, regulators obviously have to respond to that. So it's a process of synthesis, right? It's obviously there'll be some negative reactions, there'll be some positive reactions, but I don't think you can get, you get to put this genie back in the box, right? I think this cat is out of the bag now, and people have to really get on with the program.
Which of the governments are you identifying or noticing, you know, are kind of leading the way or kind of on the cutting edge of this, as opposed to those that maybe are laggards and taking, you know, a much slower approach to adoption?
That's a slightly hard question. I don't want to point any names on that question. but I can tell you that, you know, I and Sani and our general counsel, Rebecca, speak to quite a few policymakers and regulators and agencies from around the world. And obviously, they have a fair concern around some of the risks. You know, if any new technology, when you create jumbo jets and when you're trying to fly, obviously, there are some accidents. And, you know, and obviously, people want to risk manage that. There are also, you know, there is always a negative reaction in people who are very steeped in the current ways and very invested in the current architecture, especially people who, you know, who are not from this digital technology savvy generation, who kind of really didn't smell the coffee while the internet was happening. So we always get various types of reactions. But I would say that in every, you know, major Western government we have spoken to, or policy institutions we have spoken to, there is a lot of excitement about the potential of this whole Web3 space. And I think the key issue is not, the key issue is, you know, the crypto community as a whole hasn't really spent enough for time or money or energy in education, right? So we've been on our own little corner, and we've grown to 2 trillion market cap really quickly over the last 2 years. And we haven't had the chance to really build some of the tools and you know, our own little groups or policy advocacy and education groups to really, you know, influence policy in a sensible direction. So now I think we're starting to see that with DeFi Education Fund, Blockchain Association, a variety of agencies, you know, now we have Coinbase, Aave, Uniswap, a variety of other really responsible players in the space, investing more and more in education and for everyone. And that's starting to move the needle, but I think, you know, we just need to do more of that. I mean, there's no shortcut to really education and advocacy. We have to inform and educate everyone.
Yeah, that all makes a lot of sense. We're actually about coming up on time. I want to toss it back to you in case you have any thoughts or any topics that we didn't really get a chance to cover today.
Yeah. I think, you know, the best way to learn about DeFi is to use it. You know, you could read articles and PowerPoints all day and it will do absolutely nothing. You know, this is literally like the internet. You can't learn about the internet without actually clicking on a browser and going to back in the day hotmail.com. So think of Aave as hotmail.com or Yahoo. And please get a MetaMask wallet, download your MetaMask wallet, get, you know, open a Coinbase account or some account and get a few crypto assets in your wallet and then play with it. You don't need to, you know, spend a lot of money or risk any money or anything. It's just go with a sense of playing with some of the major DeFi protocols to really see what's going on, how far we have come in the user experience, security, you know, the whole, the feel of the space, and then maybe play some crypto games, buy a couple of NFTs on OpenSea, Mintable, Rarible or something. So the most important thing with Web2 was to really click on things, right? If you weren't clicking on things, you missed out. I mean, you never got to .com, the benefits of .com era. Or you were too afraid and you sold Amazon too soon, right? So it's the same story with Web3. We are starting to look at the phenomenal re-architecting of the web, and the only way to really get on with the program and benefit from it is to start playing with it. Get your hands dirty and have fun.
And then just on the investing side, I thought what you had mentioned as far as, you know, giving yourself some asymmetrical optionality, right? A portion of your portfolio that's relatively small, the downside is real and known, but also the upside is kind of exponential and a much greater magnitude. So it's almost disproportionate if you can take a long enough high.
It's disproportionate. And you have to think about what you're going to regret more, right? I mean, so I think if you miss out on what's going on right now, then you're going to find it very hard to forgive yourself as a strategist. And by the way, just one key input here. So we are launching an institutional friendly product. So we are launching Aave V2 for, you know, Aave Arc, the idea of ARC is this bridge between traditional finance and decentralized finance. What ARC does is it creates a marketplace where, you know, all the entities, corporates, and institutions are KYC'd by a regulated intermediary, and they can essentially, you know, interact in an environment that they're comfortable with. So Aave ARC is live, and, you know, if there's any absolutely, and just easily reach out to me, and, you know, we'll connect you with the folks who are currently doing onboarding for ARC.
Yeah, sounds great. Ajit, thank you so much for coming on today. We really appreciate you taking the time, and think our listeners really enjoyed all of your insights and expertise. To everyone, to listen to other episodes of The Yield, please visit and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and Spotify. And for any questions on Yield Street, please visit www.yieldstreet.com or email us at investments@yieldstreet.com. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Yield. For the latest updates on the alternative investing space, go to yieldstreet.com. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. If you enjoyed the show, feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, as this will help other investors like yourself find our show. If you have any questions, please visit us at yieldstreet.com. Thanks again for listening, and see you next week. The Yield Street podcast you just heard only reflects the opinions of the host, who is an associated person of Yield Street, and does not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street or any of its affiliates or other associates. The podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell any security, and is not an offer or sale of any securities or investment product. The podcast is also not a research report and is not intended to be and should not be construed as investment advice.
Support for this podcast comes from Yield Street. Trying to time the stock market can lead to regret. At Yield Street, our alternative investments are designed to create predictable secondary income streams, providing you with tools to help put your money to work immediately. These investments in asset classes like art, real estate, and legal finance typically have low correlation with the stock market and target annual yields up to 7 to 10%. Welcome to the next generation of investing. Welcome to Yield Street. Sign up today at yieldstreet.com.